This was News You Can Use Week in Washington. A whole batch of votes, decisions, and proposals, all having a direct effect on the lives of millions of Americans.
Commissioner Davis?
Aye.
Commissioner Montoya?
Aye.
Hundreds of towns, large and small, have military bases, bases that employ hundreds of thousands of people. This week, the Base Closure and Realignment Commission voted on which of those bases to keep open and which to shut down. All ears were glued to the radio as the votes were taken. The news for Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio was good.
We're just happy. It's been a little on the edgy side the last couple of months, and nobody really knew what was going to happen, and it's just great. We're staying open.
But the axe fell hard on McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento.
We've been on this list before and fought our way off. It's going to be very, very difficult to fight our way off again.
All in all, the commission voted to shut down 90 bases and save 43 that were facing closure. The list now goes to President Clinton, who can recommend changes to the commission or can send the list directly to Congress without changes.
This agreement represents a great victory for the American people. We're going to have a balanced budget, and in the process of downsizing government, people are going to get a little bit of their money back.
That's House Budget Chairman John Kasich describing an agreement reached by House and Senate leaders on a plan to balance the federal budget over the next 7 years. Just about everybody will notice some of the cuts. Student loans, welfare programs, and hundreds of large and small government services will be cut, and the rate of growth in others, notably Medicare, will be much smaller. The Republicans also envision a tax cut, but the Senate's Pete Domenici says that's not the first thing people will notice.
We're going to get a balanced budget certified before the $245 billion is made available.
President Clinton had proposed a 10-year budget balancing program, but the Republicans ignored it. So Mr. Clinton said he'll start vetoing bills when the Republicans start sending them to his desk.
They want to do it in 7 years with a huge tax increase. We say if you do it in 10 years, have a smaller tax increase targeted to education, you can increase investment in education, in medical research, in technology, and our economic partnerships.
One big spending bill did make it through the Senate this week, the appropriation for road building and repair. Not only does the bill provide billions of dollars to maintain the roads, it also makes some fundamental changes in the way we've gotten used to doing things. For example, over the objections of Clarence Ditlow of the Center for Auto Safety, the national 55-mile-an-hour speed limit will be no more.
Lifting the speed limit for cars will result in an additional nearly 3,000 deaths each year.
But Montana's Max Baucus says the speed limit is simply not a federal issue.
State legislatures and governors have a good idea of what makes sense in their state, and they're going to want to protect their people. They're going to want to have conditions on the highways that are safe.
Another part of the bill removes the requirement that motorcycle riders wear helmets, but people in cars would still be required to use their seatbelts. A long simmering issue came to a head in the Senate this week.
I do not support Dr. Foster's nomination, but my view is that he's entitled to that courtesy.
Majority Leader Bob Dole announcing that he would bring up the nomination of Dr. Henry Foster to be Surgeon General. The nomination had been mired in controversy for months because of opposition from those opposed to abortion. Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts said that was a phony issue.
How many others have doctors have really attempted to leave the country to try and do something about the problems of teenage pregnancy? How many others have tried to keep our young people in school, such as Dr. Foster has done?
For once, Kennedy had the support of Republican Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania.
I urge my colleagues to set aside ideology, to recognize the constitutional right of a woman to choose, and not to disqualify this nominee because he's carrying out a medical procedure which is authorized under the Constitution.
But looming large in the Senate's debate was Phil Graham of Texas, who promised a filibuster to prevent a vote on Foster.
This is the wrong person with the wrong views for the wrong job. I think we can serve the public interest by saying no. I think no is the right answer. I am confident we're going to say it.
And Graham's threat was very potent. While it takes only 51 votes in the Senate to confirm a nominee, it takes 60 to shut off a filibuster. President Clinton urged the Senate to do just that.
I have one message here. Fair is fair. This man deserves a vote up or down.
But that was not to be. Twice the Senate voted on cloture, and twice it attracted only 57 votes. When the voting was all over, Foster himself said he still wants to serve the government.
This has been a long fight, but one in which I have been immensely proud to have been involved.
House Speaker Newt Gingrich continued to make waves this week, telling a New York fundraiser something has to be done about the problem of children who have no identifiable fathers.
This idea that somebody struts around a community being proud of having had 9 children by 9 different women is nonsense. The correct answer to that is to shame them out of the community. and to communicate that that is intolerable and uncivilized behavior, and it's not how Americans behave, and we're not going to have it happen in our country.
As Gingrich was speaking about parenthood, his sister Candace was across the country serving as Grand Marshal of San Francisco's annual Gay Rights Parade.
The majority of the country wants AIDS funding increased. The majority of the country feels that it's wrong for gays and lesbians to be discriminated against in the workplace. And the people in Washington don't seem to get that.
Gay rights advocates lost one in the Supreme Court this week. The justices ruled unanimously that a Boston gay group has no right to march in that city's St. Patrick's Day parade. Chester Darling, lawyer for the parade's organizers, was pleased.
It's a vindication of my client's First Amendment rights and every citizen's First Amendment rights. We're very, very pleased with the 9-0 decision.
Summer vacation season is upon us, and for many, that means a cruise at sea. A couple of those carefree cruises turned into nightmares, though. An electrical fire blacked out the ship Celebration in the Bahamas. Coast Guard Lieutenant Michael Wilson said the fire was quickly under control.
The situation is stable. The fire's out. There's no possibility right now of the fire starting again. There's plenty of food on board, naturally. It's just that it's not a real comfortable place to be without air conditioning and other comforts that they're used to.
But if the fire was under control, some of the passengers and crew definitely were not. ABC's Robert Pankow was at the dock as more than 1,700 people came back to Miami.
Passengers here are telling us that once the initial fire emergency was over, the crew broke out the liquor and far too many people got drunk, including staff members on board the ship and teenagers who got into the liquor cabinets. Those passengers say if a second emergency had broken out, the crew would not have been able to handle it in any fashion.
In Alaska, no fires, but a suspended vacation for passengers aboard the Star Princess, which hit a rock north of Juneau. Princess Cruises spokeswoman Julie Benson said nobody was in any danger.
There's power, hot water, electricity, air conditioning, great food, beverage, entertainment. They will be having a little mini cruise experience while not going anywhere.
Whenever something goes wrong, the government generally investigates. But this week, there were charges that Air Force investigators had whitewashed their reports in a series of plane crashes, and the Air Force announced it would investigate the investigators. More from ABC's Lisa Stark.
The Air Force has no independent group that investigates its crashes, and that's the problem, according to the former civilian in charge of the Air Force Safety Office. Alan Deal charges that Air Force crash investigators cover up or change findings to protect higher-ups. In a letter to Congress last year, he outlined 30 cases of what he called mishandled Air Force and Navy investigations, including one in which the wife of a pilot may have been at the controls when the plane went down. The review panel will not look at specific crashes. Instead, will examine how the Air Force investigates all its accidents. Its findings are due in 2 months. Lisa Stark, ABC News, Washington.
And in an Air Force court-martial in Oklahoma City, Captain Jim Wang was acquitted of all charges related to a friendly fire accident over Iraq. 26 people were killed when American fighter planes fired on 2 U.S. helicopters. Courtrooms across the country are busier and busier. Attorney General Janet Reno this week told the U.S. Conference of Mayors that every 2 hours, a child is killed by gunfire in the United States.
Violent acts of crime are growing at an alarming rate among young people. Juvenile arrest rates have grown nearly 40% since 1988. On average, the number of juveniles arrested for murder is double the average for young adults.
What's the answer? One part of the puzzle, said Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, is a 12-month school year.
Get back to basic reading and math and science and sports program and really make it interesting during the summer because we have certain conditions in communities and families, the drug epidemic, and the place of most safety is many times in the school.
Haberdashery Week continued at the O.J. Simpson double murder trial in Los Angeles. With our report, ABC's Greg Jarrett.
We thought we were going back to domestic discord evidence, but wound up returning to the men's department at a major department store instead. The O.J. Simpson prosecution team kept trying to come back from a disastrous demonstration of gloves. Simpson tried on the murder gloves the previous week and couldn't get them quite on. Things began this week with shoes, Bruno Magli shoes, a special kind of shoe only made in Italy. FBI agent William Bodziak says he went from Japan to Italy to finally find the shoes that matched prints marked with blood at the scene of the crime and on Nicole Brown Simpson's back. Bodziak says it could be Simpson's foot in the shoe.
Yes, I could include him as a candidate for possibly having worn those shoes.
But no one could say where the shoes in the blood at Bundy were bought or who bought them. Defense lawyer F. Lee Bailey drove that point home.
No one has located any store where it is claimed that Mr. Simpson bought such shoes.
Then the prosecution called on the shoe salesman at Bloomingdale's. Johnny Cochran saw no need for the man to appear.
They're whistling in the wind. These are the dying grasps of the prosecution.
In fact, the shoe salesman for Bloomingdale says he has seen Simpson before, but the pair of boots he remembers selling Simpson would definitely not be of the soft Italian variety, because Simpson was going to use the boots outside in the winter at a Buffalo Bills game. Glove expert Richard Rubin came back to the stand for a third time, and Judge Ito heard arguments about Simpson trying on another pair of gloves to see if they fit. The judge decided to allow Simpson to try on a pair of brand-new Aris leather lights, like the ones allegedly used in the murder, but Judge Ito said no lawyer would be able to stand up and or direct Simpson's demonstration. Deputy District Attorney Christopher Darden didn't like that and was outright rude to the judge.
Mr. Simpson won't have the opportunity at that time to put on latex gloves and jack around with us and play games with us in front of the jury.
Eventually, Judge Ito directed the demonstration.
All right, Mr. Simpson, would you show your hands to the jury, please, front and back?
The gloves fit tightly, and the expert measured the gloves and found the bloody gloves smaller than the ones Simpson successfully tried on. Later, the prosecution alleged they had pictures of Simpson wearing similar gloves, and ABC News confirmed some New York City police officers had taken such photos of Simpson at football games the season prior to the killings. Cochran and Darden were fined for being nasty to each other at a sidebar, and then, after many arguments, a DNA statistical expert came to the stand. Dr. Bruce Weir came up with huge odds that mixed blood samples found at the crime scene in the Bronco and on the gloves belonged to anyone but the victims and Simpson. But defense lawyer Peter Neufeld got Dr. Bruce Weir to admit that by not including one particular DNA marker in his calculations, he made a mistake.
The calculations should include both those possibilities for all my calculations, and if I did not include them, then I'm sincerely sorry. And I'm also embarrassed.
Dr. Weir will be back, and perhaps sometime in the next few days, the defense will rest. Greg Jarrett, ABC News, Los Angeles.
Talks about Japanese car sales in Geneva move towards the midnight hour this week. The United States is poised to place 100% tariffs on Japanese luxury cars on Wednesday, unless Japan takes steps to open its markets to U.S. auto imports. President Clinton vowed he would not retreat.
Their system is not fair, and that is what we are trying to get done. We're trying to open it so that you will have free access to their markets like they have to ours, and it's a fight worth making.
Steve Collins of the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, who is attending the talks, saw a reason for hope.
We believe that there is every basis, if the Japanese government and Japanese industry has come to the table with serious proposals to open the market, to make meaningful change, that the sanctions will not have to go into effect.
At week's end, there was enough progress that the top trade officials of the U.S. and Japan were headed to Geneva in the hopes of resolving remaining issues.
Outside of Sarajevo, the fighting may have eased. Inside the city, heavy exchanges between the two sides carried on throughout the night. There is an air of trepidation in the Bosnian capital as the city awaits the full response of the Bosnian Serbs to the Bosnian army's offensive to try and break the siege of Sarajevo.
ABC's Tony Bertley reported that the fighting in Bosnia continued unabated this week as factions disintegrated into sub-factions and as new hotspots emerged. President Clinton sought to provide some form of assistance to the British, French, and Canadians who are stationed there. But the president met stern resistance in Congress, where Senator Sam Nunn said the U.S. has no business in Bosnia.
Both NATO and the United Nations should acknowledge that, absent a near-term diplomatic breakthrough, it is time to withdraw the U.N. and NATO peacekeepers from Bosnia.
Better news for the UN from Haiti, where this weekend the people are going to the polling places to choose their next president. Brian Atwood of the Agency for International Development called the vote a celebration of democracy.
This election campaign has been remarkably free of violence, and we are now talking about simply the complications of running an election wherein there are some 11,000 candidates for 2,195 offices.
A scary night for hundreds of Japanese airline passengers. A mental patient, armed only with a sharpened screwdriver, managed to hijack a plane and hold it on the ground for no apparent reason. ABC's Mark Litke was on hand as police stormed the plane.
The plane sitting on the tarmac in Hakodate was suddenly surrounded by the stairways up to the planes and buses and police, who all seemed to come out of nowhere. And almost immediately there were reports that the hijacker, apparently just one hijacker, had somehow been overcome and was taken into custody.
Medical news was led this week by the discovery of a gene that causes a rare childhood disease. Although that disease afflicts only some 500 people in the U.S., Dr. Zach Hall of the National Institutes of Health says the gene may be an indicator of who's most likely to become a cancer patient.
Now that the gene has been identified, scientists expect to have the tools to determine, to identify these people and determine whether or not they are at risk.
In Dallas, a bump on the road to recovery for baseball legend Mickey Mantle.
Mr. Mantle is experiencing light organ rejection at this time.
Denise Walton of the Baylor University Medical Center said up to 60% of liver transplant patients experience some form of rejection. And Mantle's surgeon, Dr. Gorm Klintbaum, said it's nothing to worry about.
This is something we expect. It has happened. We're treating it.
A study last week showing that some people infected with a form of the HIV virus had developed a resistance to AIDS raised hopes this week that a vaccine against the disease might soon be developed. Dr. James Todd of the American Medical Association said that time is not yet at hand.
Vaccine is probably some years away. The HIV virus is a tricky one. Just about the time you think you have it in the corner, it mutates and becomes a different type of virus. But, you know, we're comfortable and confident that eventually a vaccine will be produced.
The man who created the vaccine that ended the last terrible epidemic, infantile paralysis, died this week at the age of 80. It was Dr. Jonas Salk who announced in 1956 that the killed virus vaccine would produce immunity from polio.
We hope that the day will come when polio will be eradicated from the face of the earth. I think we have the means by which to do it.
How important was the Salk vaccine? Retired pediatrician Dr. Ralph Tella has an idea.
In my lifetime, I would rate that as the number one health benefit to mankind.
At the time of his death, Salk was working on an AIDS vaccine. One of his colleagues at the Salk Institute in San Diego, Dr. Joseph Knoll, said the work will continue because that's what Salk's life stood for.
It reminds us in a real sense of why we do what we do. We're essentially here to understand how living things work and more than that, how we can help mankind.
The nation's second largest city will be without a pro football team this fall if Al Davis, owner of the Raiders, has his way. Davis signed a letter of intent to move his team from Los Angeles back to Oakland, the city where they began. While that's bad news for Los Angeles, it's great for Oakland Mayor Elihu Harris.
The words Oakland and Raiders are synonymous, and even when they went to Los Angeles, it choked in many people's throats to have to put Los Angeles and Raiders together, and it wasn't just the smog that made that happen.
Golf's big winner this week was Corey Pavin. He made his first major championship a historic one, the 100th U.S. Open Tournament. The Open is traditionally played on a very difficult course, and Pavin won it at Shinnecock Hills by playing even par.
It was hard to hit greens. I mean, it was just difficult to keep it on the putting surface, so chipping became a big part of the game, and those 5-6 footers became a big part, and I just kept at it, just real tenacious out there, and just kept waiting and waiting, and finally a few things went right.
A century-old wound was healed this week in Atlanta. ABC's Al Dale attended the meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention.
All in favor?
By an overwhelming show of hands, Southern Baptists passed a resolution apologizing to blacks for the church's racist past, including its support of slavery. In 1845, many Southern Baptist preachers and parishioners defended the right to own slaves, and as recently as the 1960s, opposed civil rights for African Americans. To some, the Southern Church even came to be known as the denomination of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, I think it's always good for those of us of the family of God to repent.
The Reverend Gary Frost, who was elected second vice president, responded to the passage of the resolution.
We accept your apology, and we extend to you our forgiveness.
Al Dale, ABC News, Atlanta.
How do you like your summer weather? In this first week of summer, much of the nation was already sweltering in record heat. Bob Anderson of International Falls, Minnesota, said 80 degrees is just too hot.
I can tell you that it's very tough on we native Minnesotans.
We prefer 30 below.
But the end of the school year couldn't come too soon for these kids in San Antonio.
I like swimming best because I'm usually really hot during the summer. I ride my bike.
I like hunting, fishing, and all those other sports.
That's the sound of mighty water, Niagara Falls. And this week, early morning tourists were surprised to see a little barrel emblazoned with plugs for various TV shows bobbing toward the brink. 28-year-old Steve Trotta and Lori Martin were inside. They both completed the 167-foot plunge with only minor injuries. They were, however, arrested. Another potential jailbird turned up in Colebrook, New Hampshire. A 7-year-old first grader was late for school, feared his bike wouldn't get him there fast enough, so he borrowed a car. Colebrook Police Chief Mike Selecki spotted him.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, he's driving. I mean, he was standing out. You could see he was standing, holding onto the top of the steering wheel and apparently working the gas as he was standing. And then when I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was going to be late for school, I mean, I commend the kid for that, but driving isn't the way. You know, he figured if he had a vehicle, he could get there faster because he was running late.
On the way home, the little boy asked the chief if he could drive the police cruiser. And those are the people and events that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Stu Chamberlain. I'm Chuck Sievertson, ABC News, New York.
This has been a presentation of ABC News. More Americans get their news from ABC News than from any other source.